You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 30th of March 2023 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Guy Delaunay. Coming up, Sweden summons Russia's ambassador for his threats about his host's impending NATO membership. Will Moscow follow through? Stand by for expert analysis. Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau fingers China for disrupting democracy.
We have, like I said, known for a long time that China and others engage in foreign interference in Canada, including during our elections.
Plus, there's always been a special relationship between Germany and the British monarchy.
I'm very glad to record that one of the irreversible changes for the better in my lifetime has been in the relationship between the United Kingdom and Germany.
We'll hear a diplomat's view on the first state visit of King Charles. We'll also have a roundup from the Emirates, the morning's front pages, and slow going at some of the world's best-known museums. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, though, a look at what else is happening in the news. Russia's military is conducting drills of its strategic missile forces in Siberia in a display of the country's massive nuclear capability as the fighting in Ukraine continues. Taiwan's president has arrived in New York on a sensitive US stopover en route to Guatemala and Belize. And Australia's government has taken the first formal steps towards a referendum to recognise indigenous people in its constitution. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, perhaps Viktor Tarantsev has been reading the Moscow edition of How to Win Friends and Influence People, because Russia's ambassador to Stockholm certainly hasn't impressed his hosts. It follows his warning that Sweden would become a legitimate target once its NATO membership is confirmed, and the same would go for neighbouring Finland. Sweden's foreign ministry issued an immediate summons for the ambassador to explain himself. And, you know, it's perhaps also a good time for us to look at why NATO membership for Scandinavian countries is such an issue for Russia. Charlie Salonius-Pasternak is senior research fellow for the Global Security Research Programme at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs in Helsinki. And he joins us right now on The Globalist. Charlie, this undiplomatic language from the Russian ambassador to Stockholm, it's not exactly surprising, is it? It's kind of, you know, true to form for Russian diplomats when it comes to NATO issues.
It absolutely is. Interestingly, we rarely see quite similar language from Russian counterparts at the Russian embassy here, but it certainly is on par. And I guess something to be expected, but not something to be concerned about.
What is Moscow's motivation for this? Because my patch is usually the Western Balkans. That's where I live. And I've seen two countries on my patch join NATO while I've been there, Montenegro, North Macedonia. And all throughout the accession process, you had Moscow making these threats. It's an aggressive move. NATO will pay the price, as would the countries concerned who are joining. Why do they go through this? Surely they know it doesn't achieve anything.
They probably feel they have to. Part of the Russian idea of what it is to be a great power is to have spheres of influence. And that means that you can, you know, dabble or influence or change domestic politics, foreign policy of your neighboring countries. So there's a sense that unless they try to do this, unless they make a big show of it, they somehow themselves you'd view themselves as less of a great power.
I'm interested that you say that you don't hear those sort of rumblings, that saber-rattling in Helsinki from the Russian embassy there. I wonder why. I mean, especially bearing in mind the history between Finland and the former Soviet Union, why it is that you're not getting those rumblings there?
It's an interesting question, which we've been speculating about here, too. One of the answers may be, in fact, in how Finnish authorities react, or in fact, usually don't react to this kind of stuff. The sense is that you really don't need to be provoked by every single kind of statement or social media post. Just kind of let it go. And sometimes ignoring a great power, whether or not Russia or, say, China, that annoys them, in fact, far more. because all of a sudden, you know, a small country like Finland really doesn't actually, or it shows that it doesn't actually even care. But there's probably a range of reasons why we see and hear less of it from Finland than in, for instance, Sweden.
In terms of Sweden and Finland and their potential NATO accession, and we can get on to what the obstacles, the real obstacles to that might be in a moment, but how does it affect, how would it really affect Russia? Because, you know, when I heard them talking about Montenegro and North Macedonia, I think, well, really, that's actually quite a long way from where you are in Moscow. But Sweden and Finland less so.
I mean, the reality is, of course, that NATO is not a threat to Russia other than ideology-wise. There's lots of countries that want to join NATO and the EU, too. There's really very few that actually want to join Russia. So maybe from an ideology point of view, militarily, clearly not, because otherwise Russia would not have withdrawn most of its land forces from kind of its western borders to go to Ukraine. And, you know, Finland, assume Sweden too, they're going to keep the relationship we've tried to build with Russia. Of course, right now it's non-existent. The Finnish border guards certainly talk with their Russian counterparts. And this is likely to continue. Finland's not somehow magically going to turn into an aggressive neighbor. Russia will, however, use this in its rhetoric. It will accuse Finland and Sweden and NATO of being aggressive and, you know, doing military exercises. Well, yes, Finland, in hopefully after next week as a NATO ally, will continue to practice defending itself. But it's quite obvious that NATO does not have any designs, nor could it have any designs against Russia. So it's really about Russian self-perception. And of course, Finnish and Swedish NATO membership will make it much harder for Russia to pressure, say, Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania, because this whole region will be much more easily defendable in the future.
If you're inside Sweden and Finland right now and you're hearing the talk from a representative of the Russian government saying that those countries, your countries, would be legitimate targets if they join NATO. I know what you've said about the Finns being terribly sanguine about all of this and almost doing a little bit of roll eye and probably thinking back to the times when you beat large numbers of Russian forces with skis and Molotov cocktails. But, you know, doesn't it give some people the collywobbles, thinking, you know, all of a sudden we are going to have a proper nuclear power who's now considering us to be a legitimate target for those weapons?
Absolutely. And on the flip side, it'll be one of the large, I'll call it, cultural changes or mindset shifts that will be required for both Finland and Sweden of being now part of a collective defense family and alliance, the ultimate backbone of which is a nuclear deterrent. So that'll certainly be something in even how Finns and Swedes conceive of these things, how they communicate. For some Finns, certainly, it might be a concern, and it has come up in Finnish discussions about NATO membership over the years. In reality, of course, we now know because of archives that during the Cold War, had there been a NATO-Soviet Union war, the Soviet Union would have used nuclear weapons on Finnish territory anyway. So one might say that, you know, now it's simply coming out in the open as opposed to before being a military secret. But of course, it would be almost inhuman not to at least consider what this might mean. The key, I guess, is to, well, on the Russian side, to behave, you know, rationally and responsibly, but also on kind of the collective Western side to ensure that we do not do anything which would escalate any potential crisis.
Now, I mentioned these obstacles to membership earlier on. Those obstacles are called Turkey and Hungary. And we've just had Hungary talking about how it's not going to give the thumbs up to Swedish accession to NATO unless it sorts out its bilateral relationship. Is this, you know, perhaps Viktor Orban working on behalf of his old mate Vlada?
Well, certainly there's been a lot of speculation. Hungary, in some ways, having talked to a number of people in Finland and Sweden, is the one that disappoints the most. I mean, they're an EU member. With Finland, there's a long-standing historical kind of connection and all of this. So to then go against Finland and Sweden wanting to improve their security in the same kind of way Hungary wanted to earlier has been truly disappointing. One cannot help but wonder, what is it in Viktor Orban's head that makes him want to align himself more with Russia and Vladimir Putin than with his genuine European friends and allies?
You've also talked about, Charlie, Finland being better prepared than Sweden for the NATO accession process. What sort of preparation was this?
I think very quickly when kind of Finnish political decision makers had realized that they need to prepare for the eventuality of seeking NATO membership, kind of the Finnish diplomatic corps writ large was assigned the job of find out from every NATO member what they think about Finnish NATO applications in a situation, we have to remember, where there was a large war in Europe and we did not know how it was going to turn out. And Finland did this work. And by all accounts, every single existing NATO member said, yes, Finland is welcome. Then what, in a way, was the wrench there was Finland did, of course, not ask, well, what about Sweden if we do this together? But Finland certainly did its homework to ensure that if it was going to signal to Russia that it will seek NATO membership, there weren't going to be any roadblocks. This had to kind of, the ducks had to be in order. It all had to go smoothly. And it would have been a catastrophe diplomatically had Finland then found out that no, the United States or someone is opposed to NATO membership. So Finland certainly did its homework on this.
The contrasting diplomatic approaches of Sweden and Finland. Thanks for bringing us up to speed on that, Charlie. That's Charlie Salonius-Pasternak speaking to us from Helsinki. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter, to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Welcome back to The Globalist. I'm Guy Delaunay. It's 7:13 here in London, and that means it's 3:13 in the morning in Rio de Janeiro. And that's where they're expecting the return of Jair Bolsonaro. The former president has been conspicuous by his absence since Lula da Silva emptied him out of the executive office in last year's election. But now he's apparently hoping to revive his political career after an extended sojourn in Florida. Now, that might not be music to Lula's ears, but on the other hand, it's not exactly likely to be a harmonious return for Mr. Bolsonaro. He's facing no fewer than 5 Supreme Court investigations, as well as other accusations that could land him in lower courts. Fiona McCauley is the Professor of Gender, Peace and Development at the University of Bradford and an expert in all things Brazilian. Welcome back to The Globalist, Fiona. Why is Mr. Bolsonaro coming back now?
Well, I think that there is a view, at least by those around him, his supporters, that the Lula government has now essentially finished the honeymoon period of 100 days. You know, there's not been much movement in the economy. Lula himself has made a couple of unfortunate declarations that have caught headlines. There are questions maybe about Lula's age and his health. So there is an optimistic view that this is a good moment for Bolsonaro to come back and, you know, shake up the right and give them some more energy. Whether that will actually happen, I'm not sure, because I think there are a number of factors that would militate against that. But there is an optimism that he can come back and assume leadership of the right, the far right, because really no alternative leader has actually emerged in his absence. So there are a number of questions about whether he can lead that right to another electoral victory in 4 years' time. It's not clear, actually.
I know we've had the comparisons all along with Bolsonaro and Trump, and I find it curious that these two political figures are both losers. They've lost their elections. In Trump's case, he lost the popular vote twice. So why is it that people continue to rally around somebody who's actually a confirmed loser? That's really curious.
Well, it is. And I think one should be cautious about how many people are doing the rallying. I mean, I think that with Bolsonaro's absence for 3 months overseas, the people I was talking to in Brazil were basically saying to me, even those who were in his party, he's yesterday's man. So I think that while there's a lot of sort of hero worship by a particular rump of supporters, you know, who still see him, I mean, his middle name is Messiah, so it's, you know, they do see him as a kind of savior of the country. But, you know, the people who voted for him in the past were a very diverse group of people. And although he did get a very considerable vote, nearly half of the vote in the last election, he did lose. And I think that that fact in itself has already begun to sort of chip away at that very broad base of support. And I think what he'll be left with is a vocal minority who want him back. I mean, he seems to want to run again for re-election, of course, whether he'll be able to because of all the court proceedings against him. You know, his wife, at one point a couple of months ago, was being put forward as a possible alternative candidate, and apparently that has been vetoed. He wanted to come back. He's sounding confident as if he had that broad base of support. But I think that day by day it's narrowing, and people in his own party, the Liberal Party, like, yeah, well, you know, he's spoilt goods, he lost, so ultimately we do need to find somebody else. But nobody else has emerged in the meantime.
Interesting. How much of a problem are all these? I mean, we mentioned the Supreme Court investigations. I know there's all sorts about, you know, embezzlement of gifts of jewellery and all sorts that's hanging over him. How serious are those threats to him?
Well, I think the most serious ones are the ones that the electoral courts are investigating for electoral misconduct, whether that's participating in the dissemination of fake news, whether that's the denial of the results of the last elections. There are a number of misconduct cases that would just simply render him unable to run again. And those are probably the most serious. Because if that's where his ambition is to run again for office, then that would block that completely. I mean, what has happened now is that because he's an ex-president, he no longer has privileges to have his cases heard, all the cases against him at Supreme Court level. So there are two categories of case, the ones that the Supreme Court retains, and they're not very friendly towards Bolsonaro, despite his sort of attempts to influence it, but really he's railed against them. So those ones that they retain, I think, are a big danger to him. But the other, there are many, many people have lodged, you know, all kinds of court cases against him for all kinds of reasons, and those are now dispersed through the lower courts, and any prosecutor could actually now bring charges of any description against him. Now, even if he were to be found guilty on those charges, that wouldn't stop him running again for office. So the real danger does come from the Supreme Electoral Court. Well, there's about 12 charges cases against him that are currently live.
And in terms of the potential for stirring up trouble, I mean, we saw that even when he wasn't present, there was trouble ahead of Lula's inauguration in January. Is there a danger that you once again get this very polarised political strife that ends up on the streets in Brazil?
I mean, certainly there is a kind of plan afoot to get him, you know, moving around the country, whipping up support, doing his sort of famous outdoor rallies, you know, meeting with allies across the country. So I think there is some potential of that. I'm not sure you'd get that level of violence again. I mean, I think that the shock to the system that the events of the 8th of January delivered which prompted all kinds of soul searching and reorganization of the security forces. I'm not certain that that would happen again, but remember that a lot of the whipping up of support happened in online spaces that are quite hard to monitor. So the fake news factor is quite large. I don't think you actually, you know, the far right doesn't require on the streets violence to maintain its base. So I don't think we'll see that again, not in the immediate future anyway. It would only really happen around election time if it did happen.
Well, we'll be bracing ourselves for anything, Fiona. Thanks very much for joining us. That's Fiona McCauley. Thank you for coming in to The Globalist. And now, still to come on the programme.
I'm very glad to record that one of the irreversible changes for the better in my lifetime has been in the relationship between the United Kingdom and Germany.
6 months after the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, King Charles III begins his first world tour in Germany. But does the crown still hold soft power in Europe? This is The Globalist. And now let's head to Canada, where the country's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has appointed a special rapporteur to investigate allegations that China has interfered in Canadian elections. That follows weeks of criticism that he wasn't taking the issue seriously. Monocle's correspondent in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, has been following the story.
Well, after nearly 3 years of being in prison in China, the two Michaels are now safely back in Canada.
On the 24th of September 2021, two Canadian men, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, known in Canada simply as the Two Michaels, returned to Canada after nearly 3 years in prison in China. Their return, in the company of Canada's then ambassador to Beijing, received blanket coverage in the Canadian press, which had followed the two men's plight throughout the years of their imprisonment. Their incarceration was widely seen as retaliation by China for the arrest in 2018 in Vancouver of the Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou at the request of the United States. So, when a news report published last week alleged that a sitting member of parliament had meddled in the affair by allegedly urging China's consul general in Toronto to delay the release of the two Michaels, much of the country was stunned.
Let me be clear. What has been reported is false, and I will defend myself against these absolutely untrue claims. But let me assure you, as a parliamentarian and as a person, I have never, and I will never, would never advocate or support the violation of the basic human rights of any Canadian. Of anyone, anywhere, period.
In that emotional speech to Parliament, Han Dong announced his resignation from the governing Liberal Party, while the claims, which he denies, are investigated.
To my wife, Sophie, and my kids, I love you. I thank you for all the support and love you give me. The truth will protect us. Our honor and our family will get through this together. Sorry about that. Thank you, Speaker.
This is the latest allegation in a series of claims reported in Canada over the past few months that allege a deep and concerted effort by China to interfere in Canada's affairs, from claims of election meddling in the federal elections of 2019 and 2021, to allegations even of interference in provincial and even mayoral elections. Besma Mamani is a professor of international politics at Canada's University of Waterloo, and she explains how the allegations first came to light.
Well, we've had a whistleblower that has come out, and the whistleblower works for our CSIS, which is our central quasi-intelligence agency, if you will, to give you sort of an American example, although it doesn't have nearly the same amount of scope and breadth as the CIA would, but our intelligence arm. Now, the whistleblower is not saying anything new. In fact, if you looked at CSIS reports from several years, they noted that there is absolutely Chinese interference in our domestic politics, that they are supporting certain candidates over other candidates, not always one political party or the other, but it seems as though many of the candidates they supported were I'd say overwhelmingly from the Liberal Party. And I don't think it's because there's any special love for Trudeau. It's just they work to stop the rise of some conservative candidates who were absolutely going to be far more hawkish on China. And so what they've done is there's allegations that they interfered by boosting certain candidates over others. Now, it's important to note that our current political party in power does not have a majority. It has a minority. So it's not clear that this would have made a difference to the overall result. It might have changed the dynamics by up to, say, 9 seats. That's not nothing, but it wouldn't have made a qualitative difference to the final outcome. That's not to discount the severity of the accusations, because it really does erode trust in our democratic process.
Thank you so much. Like, I literally want to hug every single person in this room.
Another recent allegation involves the election of Ken Sim as mayor of Vancouver last October, after it was reported that China's consul general in the city had stated a desire to boost certain candidates, including perhaps Ken Sim himself, who's the first person of Chinese heritage to be elected to lead a city that has one of the largest, oldest, and most diverse Chinese populations in the entire country. It's an allegation Ken Sim has denied.
So he said that this is really unfortunate in that it seems to just cast a shadow over everyone who's Chinese, with no real clear evidence of what actually happened and who was influenced by it.
Frances Bueller is a journalist who's covered city politics in Vancouver for many years.
There's a diversity of views you're seeing out there, because there are some people from the Chinese community very anti-mainland China, who have said, yes, there are things going on and China is trying to control things and we know about what's happening in our community. You do hear that, but then you hear other people saying, but this is smearing everyone, you know, and these allegations are very broad and vague and general, and it's sort of throwing every Chinese person in Vancouver under the bus. I haven't heard a single person saying, we got this donation that was really suspicious and we turned it back. I haven't heard one story like that. I haven't heard one story about, oh, a message went out on WeChat telling people to vote for this person or not to vote for that person. So it's really hard to figure out. And even the campaign organizers will tell you, we just feel like something strange is going on, but it's very hard for them to identify exactly what.
Yes, I very much share the concerns of Canadians around interference from the Chinese governments or other foreign governments.
Pressure has grown on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to launch a full public inquiry into the allegations, which he has so far resisted, opting instead to appoint Canada's well-respected former Governor-General, David Johnston, to investigate the claims in their entirety. And despite the criticism his political opponents have levied at him for his apparent hesitation in investigating the claims, it's a stance that isn't entirely unjustified, according to Herschel Ezrin, who served as a Canadian diplomat under a previous Conservative government.
You run a public inquiry, A, you don't know where it's going to lead. I mean, just talking about it from a government point of view. And secondly, that's no way to practice diplomacy, because all of a sudden you're letting anybody with any different kind of attempt, axe to grind, to go ahead and criticize. So I would say that was the rationale for why Mr. Trudeau didn't do it. Whether he was right or wrong, or whether he should have moved more quickly to establish a special rapporteur, which he's done with a former governor general who is eminently qualified to review this and to decide even if there should be a public inquiry about it. I think the real argument will be ultimately, was Mr. Trudeau late in establishing the system that he's finally gotten to?
So, as the work of the special rapporteur into alleged Chinese interference in Canada's domestic affairs gets underway, for Besma Momani, the sheer breadth of the claims has already started a re-evaluation for many Canadians, the security of their elections.
I think most sensible people want to shine light on this. They want to have as much investigation into what happened so that we can improve our systems. I think the majority of Canadians don't believe that the elections were illegitimate in any way, but they do want to strengthen our defenses to ensure that this doesn't happen, or at least try to ameliorate this. I don't think you're going to completely stop these kinds of influence campaigns. I think what this incident did was remove the romanticization that Canadians have of their own system as being one that is bulletproof from the ire of other countries. We have this unfortunate sense of who would want to harm Canada. We're this nice, approachable, lovely country of multicultural bliss. You know, again, that's a mythology in its own right. But the fact that we have this self-romanticization of ourselves means that we're often surprised that we are caught up in this opportunity or this chance for the Chinese to try to influence Canadian politics.
Canada is one of the most stable democracies in the world, but that didn't happen by accident, and it will not continue without effort. So to all Canadians, this is an issue that we continue to take extremely seriously. And we will continue this work to uphold and strengthen your confidence in our democracy in Canada.
For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Many thanks for that report, Thomas. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russia's military is conducting drills of its strategic missile forces in Siberia. Mobile launchers will manoeuvre across three regions of Siberia. The aim is to display the country's massive nuclear capability as the fighting in Ukraine continues. Taiwan's president has arrived in New York on a sensitive US stopover en route to Guatemala and Belize. Tsai Ing-wen will stay in the city until Saturday. She's also due to meet House of Representatives Speaker Kevin McCarthy in California on her return from Central America. Taiwan's armed forces say they're watching for any moves by Beijing while Tsai is abroad. And Australia's government has taken the first formal steps towards a referendum to recognise Indigenous people in the constitution. The vote would be held between October and December, and it would also propose setting up an Indigenous voice to Parliament to advise lawmakers on matters that affect them. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. You're listening to Monocle 24. I'm Guy Delaunay. And King Charles III has arrived in Germany for his first overseas state visit as monarch. Yesterday, Berlin rolled out the red carpet and welcomed Britain's head of state with a gun salute. The visit has been viewed widely as a charm offensive intended to strengthen relations with EU members. But how much diplomatic heft does the British royal carry? The British diplomat John Everard formerly served as UK ambassador to North Korea, Belarus and Uruguay, and I asked him why it's taken King Charles so long to embark on his first tour.
State visits are always fiddly to organise. I mean, firstly, you've got to coordinate diaries. Getting dates when the king is available are fair requisite for any state visit, and importantly, when all the major politicians of the country that he's going to visit are going to be around, takes a certain amount of fiddling around. Secondly, you've got the eternal rituals of the pre-visit. Senior officials go, walk around the route, make sure that security is in place, make sure that everything's going to work out, make sure the logistics are plausible. And this can be more of a challenge in some countries than others. I suspect that the Germans had this down to a T in any case. And thirdly, you've got to worry about the content. What is the king actually going to say? Where he's going to say it? Who is going to be sitting next to him when he says it? All these things have to be very tightly choreographed, and all this takes time.
And after you've said all of this, John, it makes me think, gosh, when Emmanuel Macron cancelled or put off or asked King Charles if he would very much mind not coming due to a small matter of riots in Paris, that wasn't just like saying, oh, I'm sorry, can we do this another night? That was quite an undertaking, which he basically torpedoed there.
Yes, that's right. A great deal of work will have got into that visit. Macron will only have cancelled it because he felt absolutely that he had to do this. The French media are reporting that he had to be virtually arm-twisted into picking up that phone and calling the king. He really, really didn't want to cancel the visit. But there, with riots on the streets, he really had little choice.
Because he does like this sort of thing, doesn't he? doesn't he, Emmanuel Macron? He does like to be seen as not just the leader of France, but the leader of Europe.
There's elements of that. Emmanuel Macron, the person, I think, would have been thrilled to be sitting next to the king. You know, he likes that kind of thing just on a personal level. Macron, as the politician, yes, leader of Europe, a great statesman at a time when France needs great statesmen and is facing all kinds of trouble, and somebody with whom the great hobnob. This also looks good domestically. So lots of good reasons why he wanted the visit.
You talked about there being all these pre-meetings, John. So obviously this is where the diplomats come into play at the British Embassy in Paris, British Embassy in Berlin. What sort of input are you having at that stage?
It depends a lot on which country you are, or in which country you're stationed in. If you're in, to take your examples, France or Germany, there will be a whole buzzing of important-sounding people all wanting to have their say as to how the state visit should be organised. State visits tend to bring out the worst in people. Everybody wants to be there. Everyone wants to sit next to the king. Of course, you know, compromises have to be reached. The visits, the royal visits that I've had to organise have all been in Latin America, where you've got a lot more latitude. I mean, in Chile, for example, I organised a visit by the Princess Royal way back in 98, I think it was. And there I was able to go to the Chilean to say what she would like to do is this, this and this. And the Chilean said, that's great. Yes, let it roll. And it all went beautifully according to plan, apart from one fantastic incident, which I can't resist telling everybody.
Oh, please.
We were way up in the Atacama Desert, way up in the north of Chile, in the middle of nowhere. She wanted to go and see a copper mine. And in a village, the head of protocol said he'd just been approached by the village elder, who said they wanted to meet the princess. And I said, Princess, this is the Princess Royal? No, no, they said, our princess. Uh-huh. And out of literally a mud hut in the middle of the Atacama Desert came an immaculate vision in gleaming white. She can't be more than about 1.60 meters, the last princess of the Aymara royal house. The Chilean protocol didn't even know that the royal house continued, but ever since the Inca conquest, the Aymara had kept this going, and they were not going to let Princess Anne go through without meeting their princess.
And that happened?
That happened. They talked as equals. The Princess Royal, bless her, played a blinder, didn't blink, looks as if she's expecting this all along,
yes.
And they had a perfectly intelligent royal conversation about today's princesses' lives.
I can completely believe that, knowing what I know about Princess Royal.
Yes, she's quite unflappable.
Yes, indeed. King Charles, I nearly call him Prince Charles, that's where we still are at the moment, isn't it? We're still getting used to rolling King Charles III around our tongues. And we've been billing this as King Charles, and you know, repairing relations with the European Union after Britain's unseemly exit from the Union. How much can he actually do? How much can a visit like this actually do to heal things which seriously do need some salving?
I think actually a great deal more than people tend to understand. There's a profound symbolism in a royal visit, and you know, the Germans will appreciate the fact that you know, this was his first royal trip abroad, and he's come to Germany. These things matter to Germans. Symbolism. Also, I mean, King Charles is in a position to say things that will be widely reported across the German media. I'm sure that his speeches will be very carefully scripted and will just ooze Europhilia. But it will be noted, and yet it does have an effect.
And this visit to France, which was cancelled, is that going to have an effect on how these things will go? Or is that just, you know, a series of unfortunate events?
Unfortunate events, I think. Everybody is saying that visit will be rescheduled at the earliest possible moment, and I believe it. I mean, the programme will be resurrected as far as possible, and Macron will be particularly eager to show that a riot here or there doesn't actually completely derail a royal visit.
And that was British diplomat John Everard. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Welcome back to The Globalist. I'm Guy Delaunay. It's 7:37 in the morning in Tunis and right here in London as well, 8:37 in Zurich. And let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me down the line is Erin Claire Brown, a Tunisia-based journalist and North Africa editor at New Lines magazine. Welcome to The Globalist, Erin Claire. We have, first of all, Tunisia. Why not start where exactly where you are? And there's this... Well, let me read the headline from your own magazine, New Lines. Tunis president gives life to a Zionism conspiracy theory.
Yeah, this is a fascinating and kind of bizarre and unsettling story that we ran recently in New Lines magazine. Your listeners might know that the last few weeks and months have been rather tumultuous for Tunisia. The self-styled autocrat, Kais Saied, in late February launched a campaign to arrest many of his opponents, and we now have a lot of political prisoners. But on February 23rd, he made this incredibly incendiary speech claiming that there has been a plot to change the demographic makeup of Tunisia and turn it into a strictly black African country. Well, one of our contributors at New Lines hunted down the teeny tiny political party, the Tunisian Nationalist Party, which has only four members, that seems to be the heart of Kais Saied's obscure and kind of wacky ideology about this sort of great replacement theory. And the head of the Tunisian Nationalist Party, a guy named Sofiane Ben Saher, sat down and spoke with our contributor Monica Marx and basically laid out the idea that it's not just that there are a lot of what he claims to be a lot of black migrants in Tunisia. There aren't particularly. It's less than 1% of the population, significantly less. But that, in fact, this is part of a European Zionist plot in the same way that he claims the Europeans settled Palestine with the Jews after World War II, that the same thing was happening right now in Tunisia. Europeans were plotting to settle black Africans on their soil and to replace their country and their culture.
It's really interesting you use the phrase great replacement theory. And this is something which I usually associate with nut jobs in the United States, because your next story, which is in Foreign Policy, actually directly refers to this, how U.S. evangelicals helped homophobia flourish in Africa. Once again, spreading of extreme ideas from the U.S. to Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this last week we saw some really unsettling legislation come up in Uganda, really, really strict anti-gay bills. And I love this piece in Foreign Policy because it talks about the ways in which these kind of made in the USA movements and ideologies, these really polarizing culture war issues, especially anti-homophobia that comes from the conservative Christian right, is infiltrating in Africa and sort of taking root in places where more conservative Christian, traditional values and morals, as it were, are prominent, places like Uganda or Ghana, Zambia, and it's really starting to infiltrate the rhetoric and also starting to fund political campaigns to be able to push anti-LGBTQ legislation.
Now, we go into the Southern Hemisphere. We've got Lesotho lawmakers to debate reclaiming parts of South Africa. And this is in News 24. I mean, this is fascinating. Reparations, of course, continue to be a much debated issue. But Lesotho actually wants to go down the line of claiming bits of its neighbour.
Yeah, exactly. So this is came up from an MP from a small party. They only have one seat and it's his. And they campaigned on this idea of taking Lesotho and expanding it to include parts of Free State in South Africa. This is a movement that has been going on for a while, but unfortunately there's sort of two conflicting resolutions. One, a 1962 United Nations resolution that basically, says that there's the right to self-determination and independence for the people of what
what is now Lesotho. But unfortunately, I think they're going to be kind of stalled by the 1964 Cairo Declaration that was kind of at the beginning of the African Union that basically said, at this point, we're going to exist by, you know, the borders that exist in Africa, even if they were drawn up by colonial powers, as a way to kind of keep the peace on the continent.
The inviolability of borders. I think we know that one quite well in Europe as well. I want to finish, though. Oh, you want to finish in particular with a story from Ghana Web. And this is about Burna Boy, who, funnily enough, we were actually playing on the continental shift yesterday. And Burna Boy beats Beyonce to sell out tickets for a stadium on the same night. And this is in the Netherlands. So this is, you know, African pop beating American pop, hands down.
Yeah, I loved this story. If your listeners haven't had a chance to listen to Burna Boy, he's absolutely magnificent. He's the kind of king of the Afrobeats movement. And I loved that his fans were so exuberant about buying up tickets in Europe to sell out a stadium show before Beyonce did. In general, I think Burna Boy is just really exciting and fun to listen to. I think we've got a track lined up, actually, to kind of play out on. Just this kind of exuberant music, but that he also dives into really important social issues, including environmental issues that impact his home state or his home country of Nigeria, and the kind of exciting and political movements happening in a young and vibrant nation.
And let's have a listen to Burna Boy with Roller Coaster. Thanks very much for joining us, Erin Claire Brown from New Lines Magazine in Tunisia.
Always a pleasure. This life plenty. I keep up for my belly.
Roller coaster. People be like any. And that was Burna Boy, and before that, Erin Claire Brown from New Lines Magazine in Tunisia. I have to say, I much prefer Burna Boy to Beyonce. I'd be going for those tickets myself. This is The Globalist.
Join the club for an independent view on the world. With a Monocle subscription, you will receive 10 issues and 4 annual specials, plus access to our archive and digital editions. Full of inspiration, a subscription to Monocle keeps you informed, entertained, and ahead of the game. With a global roster of correspondents and bureau, Monocle delivers the stories that you won't find elsewhere. Sign up today and get 15% off any annual subscription. Visit monocle.com/subscribe and enter the code RADIO23.
It's 7:45 here in London, and it's time to head to Dubai now as we find out what's been making headlines in the United Arab Emirates with Mustafa Al-Rawi, a journalist and assistant editor-in-chief at The National. Welcome back to The Globalist, Mustafa. And first of all, something I was actually talking to Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, about yesterday. A Russian influx drives up rental prices in Dubai.
Morning, Guy. How are you?
Very, very good. But the question is, could I actually afford to rent in Dubai anymore?
That is a good question. I think a lot of people are asking themselves that at the moment, whether they're planning to move here, which is a lot of people, whether from Russia or elsewhere, also people who are living here. If we look at the data beyond the anecdotal evidence that I think we've all experienced and heard about, according to CBRE, in the year to February of this year, rents in Dubai have increased by 27.7%. So that's quite a rise in the 12-month period, which shows that there is, you know, a lot of froth in the market at the moment. Mm. And, you know, you mentioned Russians, obviously, since the Ukraine invasion in February of 2022, there was a lot of upheaval. A lot of Russians decided to leave Russia or other countries, and many settled here in the UAE, both in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, and elsewhere. And that's clear. You can see that. Now, I wonder if it's just Russians pushing up rents. I'm not sure that one group can do that on their own. Certainly, again, anecdotally, I'm hearing that people from all over the world, even the UK, are looking to move here as well at the moment. And that's partly because there's instability, concerns, economic malaise elsewhere, while the UAE, Dubai is looking pretty good at the moment, Guy.
Yeah, I know that Belgrade, which is on my usual patch in the Western Balkans, has been an influx of Russian people in Belgrade as well. And anecdotally, as you say, the word is that rents have gone up considerably there. So I guess, you know, maybe I don't know what the housing stock is like in Dubai, Mustafa. Maybe there's a, you know, it's supply and demand, and the demand's gone up and the supply isn't that great.
It's funny because not long ago, it was the complete opposite. There was a lot of supply. And in fact, if you look at property prices in the last decade, the peak was around 2014. Even though property prices themselves have gone up as well, I think we've seen where the market has actually been even higher than it is now. And maybe we're heading that way to fresh decade peaks. But there is a lot of supply. There's a lot of building going on. I mean, it's interesting because, yes, there's a lot of headlines around apartments and villas on the Palm Jumeirah, for example, fetching tens, if not hundreds of millions. But also out in sort of the newer suburban areas, you can pick up a villa for around 2 million dirhams at the moment as well. So there's a lot of opportunity for first-time buyers as well as the mega wealthy that are coming here. It's quite in Dubai specifically. It's quite a deep market with lots of different options. And then you have a lot of spillover in the Northern Emirates, for example, in Sharjah, where rents are a little bit cheaper, although there's a knock-on effect. So it's a big marketplace. But again, if you want to live in sort of the center of Dubai, like in any major city around the world, you're seeing a big rise in costs.
Let's go to a story in your own paper, The National. President Sheikh Mohammed names UAE Vice President and Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. Sounds like a big deal.
It is a very big story. So Sheikh Mohammed became president just under a year ago after his older brother, Sheikh Khalifa, passed away. And when he was appointed president in the federal system, of course, he also became ruler of Abu Dhabi. When he became president, there was a lot of question marks about what would happen for succession going forward. This is a big topic in the Gulf in general, not just in the UAE. And immediately after Sheikh Mohammed became president, people started talking about who might be Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. And Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed, his younger brother, who has been appointed vice president of the UAE, the second vice president, along with the Dubai ruler and prime minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid, was kind of seen as a likely crown prince. Also seen as a likely crown prince was Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed's younger eldest son, Sheikh Khalid, who is also in this news been appointed Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. So for those listening, to recap, because I think there's probably a lot
lot of quite similar names, which are suddenly flooding upon me there.
Exactly. So I'll explain it again. So we have an additional vice president of the UAE, who's Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed, who is the younger brother of Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, the president of the country. Sheikh Mansour is also very well known as an investor, as a businessman, and owner of Manchester City Football Club.
Yeah.
And then the other major appointment, there were other appointments, of course, but the other major one that everyone was looking to for the past year was who would be Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. And that is Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed's son, Sheikh Khalid. And that's an important appointment for succession going forward, but also for everybody understanding what the political landscape looks like. And then there's obviously a connection with the economic landscape. This all encourages greater stability. That these appointments have been resolved. And the interesting thing is that as Sheikh Mansour being appointed as an additional vice president, he has a connection with Dubai. He's not just an Abu Dhabi sort of big name. He's also married to the daughter of the ruler of Dubai, who was vice president as well and prime minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid. So it kind of tightens the federation as well with this appointment. So it's very interesting and perhaps a little bit of a surprise because people thought the only appointment that was coming was Crown Prince, the only major one of Abu Dhabi. And now we've had two in the same evening. So a lot of people will be talking about that today.
And just briefly, Mustafa, we've also got a story in The National. Sultan Al Nayyadi gets his first haircut in space, and this will be proudly under the banner UAE in Space that you have. How many astronauts does the UAE have?
Well, currently, Sultan Al Nayyadi is the second astronaut in space. He's on a long-term mission at the International Space Station for 6 months. But before that, the UAE already had its first astronaut. But it's part of a wider push on space, not just in terms of getting men out there, but there's a probe about to land on Mars or on its way to Mars. Sorry, there was a probe that went to Mars in orbit of Mars, and we're about to have a lander on the moon very shortly as well. So so very much the UAE wants to be at the forefront of space. But again, this is a Gulf-wide thing in this region. Many of the other economies also want to push into space, looking for how it will improve technology, sustainability, economic sentiment as well. So a nice story for Sultana Niyadi. He's been talking to students from space. He's now had his hair cut in space. He's keeping us posted on what life is like orbiting Earth.
So long-haul airlines aren't enough for the UAE. You want to dominate space as well.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Absolutely, Guy.
Thank you very much for joining us, Mustafa Al-Rawi. You're with The Globalist on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's 30-minute weekly conversation with inspiring company founders, uncovering the secrets of growing a great business and discussing the many pathways and definitions of success.
I think in your standard entrepreneurial journey, there's a lot of times when you might want to throw in the towel, but if impact is really at the heart of what you do, you don't have that option. You have to stick to your guns.
We're craving curation in a very different way and have understood how small businesses have given complete life to our streets and communities, and I think we'll value them in a completely different way, which I'm excited about.
Tune in every Wednesday at 2000 hours London time for a new episode of The Entrepreneurs right here on Monocle Radio.
And finally, on today's show, after 2 years of gloomy lockdowns and mask wearing, many of us have enjoyed heading back to museums and art galleries. But according to a recent survey by The Art newspaper, global museum visiting figures haven't quite bounced back. Well, we're joined now by Lee Cheshire, partnerships editor at The Art newspaper. Welcome to The Globalist, Lee. I was fascinated to see which of these museums are struggling. I mean, for example, the National Gallery right here in London, 3.3 million. Fewer visitors in 2022 compared to 2019. That's fairly catastrophic, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So in 2019, they got 6 million visitors, and in 2022, they only got 2.7 million visitors. So that was the biggest kind of fall in absolute visitor numbers that we saw of any museum in our survey. So yeah, that's quite a lot. But the other London museums are struggling a little bit as well. So the British Museum and Tate Modern, they went back up to third and fourth in our chart, which is their kind of normal position. And it's true, they kind of doubled or even trebled their kind of visitor figures from 2021, but they were still about a third down on where they were before COVID. So compared to cities like Paris and Seoul in South Korea, the London Museum is not doing so well.
And the Guggenheim in New York, a 42% drop in visitors in 2022 compared to its pre-pandemic figures.
Yeah, so some of the New York ones are struggling as well. You know, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is normally the sort of top-ranked museum in the Americas, but they are only eighth this year, and they're 34% down, even after accounting. They've changed the way that they count their figures, but even after accounting for that, they're still 1.7 million visitors down on where they were in 2019.
So we got the figures, we got the raw data, and we can see that some places are doing pretty well. The Louvre is planning to restrict visitor numbers due to overcrowding. But, you know, how? What's the difference? What are these museums doing right and wrong? Is there a formula, or is it just a pattern that you can't quite see? What's the cause?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think London museums have always had an advantage that they're free of charge, whereas most of the museums in the rest of the world in our survey, you have to pay to get into. But I think that advantage has been eroded in the last few years because, you know, there's more queuing. There's more kind of airport style security checks when you go in. There's perhaps at the National Gallery, you know, you used to be able to go in three or four different entrances, and now there's only one entrance. And they're encouraging people to book time slots ahead of a visit. You don't have to, but they're you know, strongly encouraged on their website. So I think that kind of reduces that advantage that they had before, that people could just pop in, you know, on their lunch break, or, you know, to use the toilet or to go to the cafe, or just to see one, you know, your favourite painting. Whereas, you know, obviously the Louvre, you've always had to buy a ticket and queue up, and you kind of expect that.
Do you think that the London museums might have a change of heart then about what they're doing? If it's hitting the National so hard, for example, I mean, you know, all the ancillary revenue, never mind that it's free to get in, but all the ancillary revenue, are they going to be losing that?
Yeah, I mean, London museums also particularly rely on that. You know, they've been very successful over the last 20 years in getting in that kind of revenue from the shops and from the cafes and trying to kind of, you know, wash their own faces. So they do kind of rely on those visitors. It'd be interesting to see what happens next year, whether how close they get back to their kind of pre-COVID levels. But it seems like a lot of their decision making around, you know, entrances is to do with, you know, security, or to do, you know, the National Gallery is doing a refit of the whole way that you would go into the museum. So I'm not sure how quick or easy these changes will be to kind of roll back.
So if any of us want to nip to the National while there's fewer people around, what's the best thing to see there?
I'm not sure at the moment, actually.
Yeah, I've put you on the spot, haven't I? I mean, I must admit, the National isn't one that I regularly go to. I mean, if I'm going to museums in London, I mean, frankly, I'm a Tate Modern kind of guy. It's, you know, day at the South Bank, heading to the Tate Modern, see what's on in the Turbine Hall. But it's interesting to hear that those numbers are down and, you know, one person's crisis is another person's opportunity. Thanks very much for joining us on The Globalist, Lee. That's Lee Cheshire. And the full report can be found in the April issue of the Art Newspaper and on the Art Newspaper's website. Well, that is all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Emma Searle, our researchers Lillian Fawcett and Andre Nikolai Pamantuan, and our studio manager Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Callum McLean. After the headlines, there's music on the way, The Briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Guy Delaunay. Thank you very much for tuning in.